do. They'll have you acting like the sun don't shine and the sky never blue. But you know and I know it's all about survival. The struggle of our people is like that unrivaled. Fuck politicians, they was never in control. It's deeper than that, a true battle for the soul. What they want is to bring us to our knees. So my people guard your life by any means.
This is for those who know we all gon' die. It's set up that way by infinite power. Those who know the feel of chains in the belly of the beast and the mental strength. This is for those who have their own fallen angels trying to find the way home. This is for everybody, everybody. And
welcome to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month on TKUT 90.3 FM.
Tonight we got a great show in store. We will be featuring an interview from McGill artist Kosi, whose art will be exhibited next Wednesday, February 6th at O Pacho Vis.
Alyssa brings us a report on a story not getting the attention and care it deserves. The survivors of the Nova Scotia Home for Colored Children have broken their silence and are now suing in a class action suit for the sexual and physical abuse they suffered, or what one survivor describes as torture.
Alyssa will also give a small comment on President Obama's second inauguration and Marilee Evers Williams, longtime civil rights activist who delivered the 2013 invocation.
We also will host a roundtable discussion about recent headlines this month. The removal of Kwanzaa, as proposed by Senator Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin. Also, the controversial film, masterpiece, question mark, Django Unchained. All this and some incredible music coming up on another edition of Spitfire Radio, Women of Color Radio on CKUT. Stay tuned. They'd cry like yours and learn to smile.
Today, Alyssa reports on a story that has not been attracting the national attention it needs. The Nova Scotia Home for Colored Children, an orphanage for black children, is coming under increasing fire after more than 100 former residents of the home are part of a class action lawsuit claiming they suffered physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. Nova Scotia Home for Colored Children.
Physical and sexual abuse stretching back decades. 140 residents at the orphanage are part of a class action lawsuit against the orphanage and the government of Nova Scotia, alleging they were sexually, physically, and emotionally abused by staff at the home. In November, the CBC's Anna Maria interviewed three former residents of Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, who are part of a class action lawsuit for damages and justice for what was done to them, allegedly, by the home. Their stories are horrifying and represent yet another part of a story of violence, abuse, and what the victims describe as torture against black Nova Scotians. The Nova Scotia Home for Colored Children first opened in 1921 as an orphanage for black Nova Scotian children. Reports show that for many decades, the Home for Colored Children received less funding than did institutions housing white children. There is evidence that the province paid less per diems for black children in its care than it did for white children in its care. This has led many to ask, what role may have such underfunding played in the abuse of these children? The home is still in existence today, bearing the same name, but the government and the current staff insist that it is not engaged in discriminatory practices. Veronica Marsman, executive director of the home, says she has no knowledge of staff abusing residents and instead alleges it may have been the children themselves who physically, sexually, and mentally abused each other, according to an affidavit filed with the Nova Scotia Supreme Court. The accusations are contained in the documents submitted by Marsman in her opposition to the proposed certification of the class action lawsuit. Marsman, the home's executive director since 2010, also worked at the orphanage and was a resident there from 1964 until 1966. She claims that with the exception of individual claims and media reports, she was only aware of the incident through the home's records in which a staff member was alleged to have had sexual contact with a 16-year-old girl in June 1983. The accused staff member was suspended and eventually fired, the affidavit said. Her affidavit says also that 63 individual actions alleging various forms of abuse had been filed with the provincial Supreme Court since 2000, and 59 are still before the court. Lawyers for the orphanage said a class action lawsuit isn't needed because the circumstances of the allegations vary considerably. Marsman's affidavit includes a list of former residents who were accused of abuse in previous court proceedings. Some of the names are people who have been alleging that they were the victims of abuse at the home. Efforts to portray the victims coming forward as criminals, or perhaps liars themselves, have been criticized by Wei Ragner, whose legal firm is spearheading the class action suit. Wagner expressed disappointment that the affidavit filed by the respondents attempts to cast blame on the alleged victims. On Wednesday, Premier Daryl Dexter was noncommittal about when or if a public inquiry will be held into allegations of abuse at the Nova Scotia Home for Colored Children. The province moved to dismiss the lawsuit in the Nova Scotia Supreme Court Monday against the certification. A court ruling is expected in June. There remains, however, many unanswered questions, and Liberal leaders are pushing the Premier for such an inquiry. There is also a push by the group Voice, Victims of Institutional Child Exploitation Society, for an inquiry that can be found at change.org. That's a petition that can be found at change.org. The group aims to hold provincial institutions accountable for the disturbing history of sexual and physical abuse by institutions in Nova Scotia, including the Shelburne School for Boys, the Nova Scotia School for Girls, the Antigonish Roman Catholic Diocese, and Scouts Canada. We will continue to bring you updates on this story as it unfolds.
Welcome back to Spitfire, Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM.
That last piece you heard was produced by Alyssa. You can check out more of her news pieces on her SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/AlyssaClutterbuck.
Kosi Negbe, or Kosi for short, is a 19-year-old McGill artist whose art has been the talk of student body at McGill. One week before her first exhibit in Montreal, this next interview, Kosi sits down with Spitfire for a one-on-one to discuss her paintings and the strong women who inspire them.
So my name is Kosi Sajkunabe. I'm a U1 student at McGill, obviously. I'm studying international development and economics, double majoring, and I'm also an artist.
Very nice. So tell us a little bit about your background. Where are you from and how you got to McGill?
So I'm originally from Nigeria. I moved to Canada when I was 5 with my siblings and my mom. We moved to Gatineau, where I grew up. And I came to Montreal to study at McGill. Yeah, pretty much it.
So like you said, not only are you a student, but you're kind of a killer artist. Okay, word is getting around. Everyone's like, have you seen Kosi's art? Have you seen Kosi's art? Let's start from the beginning. How did you know that drawing and painting is what you wanted to do?
I guess for me, drawing or pretty much writing or anything that requires like taking a pen and put it onto paper was always a way for me to communicate, because I was never like the most eloquent child or anything like that. So when it came time for me to actually try and explain how I was feeling, that's what I would go to. So either I would write poetry, which is something I used to do as well and I'm trying to get back into, or I would draw, and it just started that way. So it was a way for me to relieve stress or really just to kind of explore who I was. So it's always been something that's very related to my identity, something that I used to question myself at times to you know, just try and figure things out. So that's why I've always been doing it since I was a child, and it's something I'd never actually stopped doing. So it's always been a constant evolution. It's not as if there was one period of time where it, like, suddenly burst out. It's always been there. It's, like, something that is very me. So it's just this summer, actually, that I decided to take it a little bit more seriously. I turned 19, and I was like, oh, when I was younger, I've always wanted to be part of, like, the top 20 under 20, and I realized I hadn't done much yet. So I was like, well, might as well take this and try and do something with it. So that's why I've been doing this a lot. I've been, like, really focusing on it because I want to have something done by the time I'm 20.
What do you think your art has made you realize about yourself that words couldn't help you realize?
I think it's made me realize that I have much more of a voice than I thought I did before. You know, especially when I started doing my first series, really, is Zinwani, when I put a message behind it, and when I had people actually responding to the message, and I had written a little blog post about it, explaining, like, the inspiration, like, what made me decide to do something like that, and people would quote it on Tumblr, and that's when I realized, like, I have a voice. I can actually do something with this.
So let's talk about your paintings. Beautiful, first of all. Mostly strong, black, female figures. And it seems to be a recurring theme in your art.
Basically, it stems from when I was younger. And the images of black women that I would see weren't exactly the images that I'm representing right now. So it's kind of challenging myself to actually stop viewing women like me in that manner, you know, the way that you see them in the media, half naked, sometimes in music videos, or, you know, like the angry black woman, or any other stereotype that you can find, and instead really, like, close myself off and focus on these women and see the strength in them. So, for example, I have the Neka in the Ezinwani series, and she's the one in pink, and I love that one because it's very bold. And she's in my room right now, and she just stares at me all the time. And that's pretty much what it is. It's, like, forcing me to, like, look into her eyes and, like, really just realize black women are strong. Black women are beautiful. And that's pretty much what's repeated every time I look at them. And that's why I love those paintings so much, because it's not something I did just for other people. Rather, it's something I did for myself. And that's what I said. Like, it's really a challenge, you know, to really, like, forget everything I've learned or everything I've seen, and just like, look at it and realize that this is what a black woman is. She's bold, she's beautiful, and she's strong.
And is she a product of your imagination, or have you seen it somewhere?
She's not a product of my imagination. She's my mother, she's my sister, she's every black woman I know that's gone through so many obstacles and manages to stand up straight and strong and, you know, say whatever needs to be said and just show that there's much more to who we are than what you see in movies, what you see on the television, what you see everywhere.
What's the name of your series and what does it mean?
Okay, I'm Igbo, but I don't actually speak it, so I might not be pronouncing this properly, but it's Ezinwani. It means queen of women, and like I said, it's an Igbo name. It stems from the Igbo mask, which represents, you know, the ideal woman, kind of strong, it could be the mother, it could be the wife, it could be anything, just an elegant, strong woman. So it kind of represented, like, the royal aspect, because when I think of beautiful black women, there's always this kind of, like, regal aspect to it for me. I always see they're beautiful, you know, so, like, it just made me think of the African queen.
Neka is the name of one of the paintings. Yes. I don't know if it's an allusion to the artist Neka, or maybe both of their names mean the same thing.
It means the same thing. It means Mother Supreme. So I actually know a lot of Nekas. It's a very popular Igbo name. And I really wanted to, I like the fact that it talks about mother, and it uses mother and supreme, you know, so it's like a mother is someone who deserves a lot of respect, and she is powerful, she is supreme, like, no matter what happens, she is like your mother, and there's something that needs, that's something that needs to be respected. So why I had put that one with, that name with the pink painting was because that one was overtly sexual. Actually, my dad didn't like it at first because the body part, because the paintings are separated in two. So you have the face and then you have the body. And for that one, the body was very sexual. It's just the boobs, it's just the stomach and everything. And my dad hated it because he said it was too sexual. He didn't like the nudity in it. And kind of as a challenge to him, I wanted to kind of like, you know, this, it doesn't matter what you think, like this is still like Mother Supreme.
So what's next for Kosi, the artist?
I have absolutely no idea. When I started this, like pretty much this summer, I had no idea what I was doing. It was basically me just being like, oh, let's start a Facebook page. Oh, let's just start a series. And like, let's call it a series. I really don't know what I'm doing. But it's evolved a lot. People have been contacting me for projects and stuff like that. So like, I really, there's a lot that can happen. I'm not quite sure what is going to happen, but I think that's the best part about it, because I really, there's no set path, and I'm just exploring everything and discovering a lot of things, not only about myself, but like about everyone else as well. So it's a very fun journey, I guess.
And you have an upcoming exhibit.
Oh, yes, I do. February 6th at Au Patrovis, which is about less than 5 minutes away from Mont-Royal Station. It starts at 6, and it's just going to be a very chill night. There's going to be 3 DJs. There's going to be food. I'm going to be there, and my art is going to be there. So it'll just be, like, fun. Just take a look at the art. Grab a drink. There's going to be a bar. And just sit down with your friends and listen to good music. That's pretty much what it is.
Kosi, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And that's it. You're listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM every last Wednesday of the month. It's just around 6:17, and stay tuned because there's plenty more on this latest edition of Spitfire Women of Color Radio.
This Valentine's Day, Rock Against Racism Montreal invites you to come show your love for families of sisters in spirit. Come out to a benefit show to support the movement for justice for missing and murdered Aboriginal women. On the agenda for the evening, Studfinder, a riotous riot girl ensemble, the sultry synth soul music of Dirty Boots, and the anarchistic post-punk choreographed revelry of We Are Dying to Kill You. Oh yeah, and DJs, projections, book kiosks, and mandatory fun. That's Thursday, February 14th at Catacombs, 1635 Saint Laurent. Doors are at 8, music starts at 9. $6 to $10 sliding scale gets you in. For more information, check out facebook.com/smash.hate.mtl, a CKUT co-presentation.
Welcome back to Spitfire Women of Color Radio every last Wednesday of the month on CKUT 90.3 FM. For the next part of the show, we will turn to a brief report on the 2013 U.S. presidential inauguration.
This second inauguration of the first black president was neither the spectacle nor historical moment that the first was, but maybe it's a good sign. Maybe it means that after 4 years of much the same from the office of the U.S. presidency, folks devoted to change have gotten over the Obama mania that swept him into office as a change candidate in 2008. Watching with the intrigue and cynicism that I always have when observing U.S. political pageantry, the cannons, the eagles, everybody all the time one-upping the U.S. military, I was pretty bored this time around watching the Obamas, with the exception of Michelle's bang. A pleasant surprise, however, was the presence of Merle Evers Williams on stage at the National Mall. Evers Williams is a civil rights activist and journalist who worked tirelessly for decades to seek justice for the murder of her husband, Medgar Evers, in June of 1963. Medgar became the Mississippi field secretary for the NAACP in 1954, and Merle worked alongside him. Together, they organized voter registration drives, civil rights demonstrations against the practices of racial segregation in schools and other public facilities. They campaigned for voting rights and for universal suffrage for American adults. As prominent civil rights leaders in Mississippi, Medgar and Merle became high-profile targets for pro-segregationist violence and terrorism. In 1962, for example, their home in Jackson, Mississippi was firebombed in reaction to an organized boycott of downtown Jackson's white merchants. The violent threats reached the tragic point in the following year, when Medgar was gunned down by a white supremacist and Klansman named Byron Dilep Beckwith, Dilla Beckwith, or Beckwith as I will call him, was also affiliated with the White Citizens Council, a white supremacist group formed in response to the U.S. Supreme Court's 1954 ruling in Brown v. Board of Education that school segregation, that separate but equal, was unconstitutional. Beckwith shot Medgar in front of his home in the early morning of June 12, 1963. Merle, home with her three children, rushed outside to find her husband dead. There were two trials in 1964 where the state of Mississippi tried to prosecute Beckwith, but both all-white, all-male juries did not convict him. It was later discovered that the state of Mississippi used taxpayer funds to support the defense legal team of Beckwith. This did not deter Merle, as she continued to push for justice for her husband's murder. Finally, in 1994, Beckwith was convicted for the murder of Medgar Evers. Merle moved to California in the late 1960s to continue her work on civil rights causes and activism. She obtained a bachelor's degree in sociology and served as NAACP chairwoman from 1995 to 1998. Today, Evers Williams is a distinguished scholar at Alcorn State University in Lorman, Mississippi. On January 21st, 2013, Martin Luther King's Jr. Day, and the second inauguration of President Obama, Merle Evers Williams was the first woman and the first layperson to deliver the invocation of the presidential inauguration, a fact not lost on many from past and present civil rights activist generations who know that their work is far from complete. Merle's presence reminds us that the second generation of the first black president must not succumb to waiting for our hopes and dreams to be actualized in the U.S. Congress or the State of the Union speeches, but in our constant pushing, demanding, and refusing to lower our standards of social and economic justice, fairness, and respect for all around the world. Thank you to Merle for your bravery, past and present. We love you.
You are tuned into Spitfire Women of Color Radio.
All the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
Turned in to Spitfire Women of Color Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is just about 6:30. For the next part of our show, we're turning to a news roundtable. Victoria?
Yeah, Django Unchained. The D is silent. Last month's release of Quentin Tarantino's latest film has sparked a tense debate that dates back to questions of the role of black representation, black art, and art that grapples with the horrors of transatlantic slavery. Some have accused Tarantino of luxuriating in violent imagery, while others maintain that the discomfort with the film indicates that our culture still has not yet dealt with the totality of slavery's impact. So today we've decided to have a roundtable on this amazing film, and I just want to also recognize all the awesome people in the studio today. So Malak, Mercedes, a friend of ours, Michelle, Yaz is here, hola. Alyssa, myself, Victoria. So yeah, we're just going to discuss and unpack some issues that I'd like to point out. The question of historical accuracy of the film, that's something that the news media was really talking about. The use of extreme language, violence, as well as the potential threat of this film inciting some kind of African-American rebellion,
they're going to start killing all the white people.
Is that basically it? Anti-white bigotry, the role of the white director Quentin Tarantino, and also representations of femininity, like the female characters in the film. So there's lots to choose from. Maybe we can, just pick one.
Do you want to talk about which one specifically, Victoria?
Well, okay. Let's talk about violence first. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. There's lots of blood in the film. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I thought in terms of connecting violence to historical accuracy, I actually felt that in terms of violence towards slaves in the movie was very accurate, you know, with the whipping of Kerry Washington and the way that the slave traders were talking to the slaves, treating them. The movie opens with about like seven slaves like walking in like iron chains, you know, towards a next location.
And what it had done to their ankles.
Yeah, and I felt like that was very accurate and I liked it because it made people very uncomfortable, but I feel that violence was incited like by humans against other humans, and right. I think it's very important for us to kind of stare in the face of like violent humanity and really accept that, because it did happen. I mean, so I feel in that sense it was
for sure.
I think that I don't have a problem with the violence in the film at all. I will say that I watched an interview with Tarantino before the film was released in December, and he was talking about how when they initially screened the film as a test run, that it was much more graphic than it actually the final cut turned out to be. For example, there's a scene of a slave of Leonardo DiCaprio's character who is getting ripped apart by dogs. Mm. And initially that scene was much more spot on, you know, the angles and the cuts that were used were much more, there was no way you could miss it. The way it's edited in the version that I think we all saw, I mean, you know what's happening and it's horrible and you can hear the dogs and you can hear the squeals, but you don't see it spot on. And a similar thing he said, he changed with the Mandingo fighting scene. Like the original one was actually much more graphic, and then he decided to take it back. But I mean, I guess I want to say also, and I really loved the film, so I just have to say I have a lot to say because I loved the film. But
I loved the film.
Just in case it wasn't. Did you guys hear that I love the film? I really love the film. Hi, I love the film. Spoiler alert: the ending was amazing. But I guess it's just sort of how does a 2.5 hour film grapple with all of the violence of slavery? I just feel that this, because there's not enough films and not enough outlets where slavery is discussed, this film, and it's directed by someone who's not the descendant of a slave, so it's easy to put all of this stuff on this film and say, you didn't talk about this, you didn't represent this as accurately, but it's like, maybe that's because our culture doesn't understand how this is, this violence is actually not that far removed from us.
But yeah, also in response to that, I just want to say, like, there are really two different kinds of violence, and the pleasure or the pain of experiencing violence on the screen that's in the film. So because it's Quentin Tarantino, right? Like he does these revenge narratives where we all get to participate in the hero's or the heroine's excessive use of violence to, you know, get a sense of justice and satisfaction. And often to the point of like kind of a very like, you know, very gory, you know, sort of tasteless sort of way of reveling in a parody of violence, right? So you have the parody of like
classic Tarantino,
exactly, of like putting a bunch of Nazis into a film auditorium and then burning the building down, which is what happened in Inglourious Basterds, where you have this, you know, Holocaust victim, you know, taking her revenge directly on Hitler, and you see all these people like trying to escape a burning building, right? That's violence, but it's in a different class of, say, like the historical representation of real lived, you know, pain and violence. So I think like with Tarantino, people can skewer the debate because which kind of violence are we really talking about?
Yeah.
Right? Because there are two different kinds that are going on there. It's his, like, the gratuitous, maybe the taking the pleasure of, like, you know, giving the power to Jamie Foxx to be, you know, the cowboy that we will identify with, sort of like we can identify free reign with Clint Eastwood in his cowboy films, where we see him like taking down all of these bad guys, and we enjoy that kind of violence, and that violence isn't necessarily questioned, at least in mainstream circles. Here it is questioned because it's a revenge narrative of, you know, things that have happened that I think arguably, you know, culture hasn't really dealt with, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, and I also feel that what you said about the multiple levels of violence really resonates with me. So for me, what was so interesting was not necessarily classic Tarantino shots of blood splattering really gruesomely when people are getting shot with rifles, but there's a scene early on in the film where Jamie Foxx's character gets hooked up with the bounty hunter who mm-hmm. is essentially going to help him get back to his wife that is a slave of Leonardo DiCaprio. And they're just something as benign seemingly as riding in on a horse in the middle of a town in a very Western looking motif and seeing a shot where there's like a noose hanging from one of the rooftops and watching the shot of Jamie Foxx's head as he's riding on the horse going across the noose. It's not that it actually is going to come close to hanging him, but just this idea that
the visual
and the symbolism. I just felt like there were so many touches like that and so many points where I was like, oh, this is so interesting. Like just as a visual, just visually, it was very interesting.
That's interesting. I actually completely missed that scene, so. It's definitely a lot of subtleties going on.
For sure. What did you think about, say, what do you think about this question of anti-white bigotry, which is to say that, like, this is racist towards white people, this kind of narrative?
I mean, I thought it was ridiculous and very silly, frankly. I didn't necessarily think that it was anti-white. I thought it was anti-slave owners.
Exactly.
Who frankly happened to be white at the time. I'm sorry that y'all ancestors owned some slaves, but that is what had happened. So
yeah,
I don't know a way to get around that.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. You know what, though? This is interesting. Sorry, it's Alyssa talking again about how much I love the film. Because I find that reaction much more honest than what I've seen from a lot of kind of mainstream liberal commentators that the film is luxuriating irresponsibly in violence. Because think about it, there are still representatives and factions in North American society that are pro slave owner.
Right.
So it therefore makes sense that there are outlets out there like the Drudge Report, for example, that makes a mockery of blackness all the time and is constantly antagonizing Obama for being this angry, lazy, shiftless, you know, black aggressive man. And they do this with all types of black people who are well known. So that to me is totally fine. I mean, I'm never going to agree with somebody who at any point in time is pro slave owner, whether they're reading of the Civil War or not. But I feel like that's much more honest.
If you have a Confederate flag bumper sticker,
and
we're not going to agree.
That's honest. Yeah. But if you're like, say you're a liberal and you don't like this movie because it questions some of the assumptions that you feel, are important to make slavery work for you in a way that rationalizes how you see yourself as not racist or as, you know, on the right side of history in terms of like how you come down on social issues. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's uncomfortable because it is kind of in your face and it is forcing you to attend to these dynamics.
And I love the fact that the sort of the agent of Django's liberation, the one who buys him and gives him his freedom, the one who teaches him how to shoot, the one who brings him in, is the whitest white person. I mean, he's German, and we know that, like, not half a century later, the Holocaust is going to be played out. And when we think about that controversial term, Nazi poster boy, it's a white German person. And so I just thought it was interesting that Quentin Tarantino chose a German character to portray that profoundly anti-racist role, and he's sort of making a commentary about it's really the quality of the character of these people, not the fact that they happen to be a certain skin color.
Yeah,
for sure. Mercedes.
Hi.
Did you watch the film?
No, I didn't. But I've been hearing a lot of commentary. So, I mean, when I do see it, I guess all this will be flitting around my head.
Well, it's funny because we haven't even actually told the audience what the film's about. We've just talked about the violence and the blood.
They can wiki it.
But, like, I guess I'm just going to repeat, like, the narrative arc being that basically a slave is freed by a bounty hunter a German bounty hunter who needs him to identify his next victims. And then he befriends this slave who wants to go rescue his wife, who's being held at a plantation by the evil Leonardo DiCaprio and Samuel L. Jackson plays a huge role in this place called Candyland, which is an estate, and he plays a house slave. So moving along, I just wanted to ask you girls about the female characters in the movie. Like, this obviously is, you know, woman of color show. So what about the women?
Yeah, that was definitely the one part of the movie that I really had an issue with. There's a famous female filmographer, last name Bechdel, who came up with something called the Bechdel test. And it's a really simple way to analyze how woman-friendly a film is. And there's just three very simple criteria by which you judge a film. One, are there two women characters who have names? At least two women characters who have names in the film. Two, do they talk to each other at any point in the film? Three, about anything other than a man? And so on this really simple three-rule criteria, I mean, Django fails a basic Bechdel test. And the Bechdel test is interesting because it speaks more broadly about the way in which not only women but men are portrayed in most popular films.
And specifically the Western, too, if you think about it.
Definitely in the genre of the Western. Form. And it's basically this message that a heroic man is one who defeats evil through the use of violence and then gathers his prize, which is a woman who has no friends and doesn't speak.
Oh, goodness.
So I definitely thought that Django fit in that, unfortunately. And one scene that brought it home for me was she is in bed. She's in her, you know, room. And I guess men have been coming in and out all night, and she hears a knock at the door, and she's terrified. She's like shaking in her bed. And then Django opens the door. She doesn't see him because her back is turned away from the door, and he says, "It's me, baby," or, you know, whatever. She realizes it's him. She's very happy. She pops up and they start passionately kissing.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
you know,
but that feeling of suspense was definitely there.
Right. It made sense in the context of the film, but just thinking about it more broadly, I don't think a woman who's been brutally raped multiple times, his immediate reaction is going to be to get into a really hot makeout session. I don't know. So yeah, sorry, I've been going on too long, but I just thought it really oversimplified women.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that point in the sense that I felt that the movie didn't properly tackle the unique experience of being a female slave. Mm-hmm. Like, they didn't deal with issues of rape. And I feel like the black female slave experience was so unique in itself. And there were so many trials carried by women alone in that era. And I felt that wasn't touched on at all. I think there was one point where he was talking to the German, and he mentioned that Kerry Washington was very beautiful, so that she wasn't working in the fields and that she might be like a comfort girl, which I guess were the women who only had sexual relations, basically like not a prostitute, but you know, she just provided. Yeah, exactly.
An unpaid prostitute.
I don't know how to describe that. But I felt like it's a term that carried so much weight, and it was just barely touched on. Yeah. And I'm just like, how can you just say that so casually? Like, that's not okay. So I completely agree in the sense that I felt like women were definitely overshadowed by the Django experience.
Yeah, for sure. You are listening to Women of Color Radio Spitfire, only on 90.3 FM CKUT. We're talking about Django Unchained.
Silent D.
Django. The D is silent.
The D is silent. And this is a pretty wicked track that RZA made for the film, so we're going to listen to it. This log will make his whole ball disconnected.
I learned to shoot the dead man with a tango. Yeah, and his name is Django.
I love you, Django.
Django, I think you should make a last request.
I love you, Django.
I'll be glad to oblige you any way I can. Start praying if you like, I don't mind. It's a smart thing to do when you know that death is coming for you. How come you haven't got your burial suit with you? We'll have to leave you to the vultures.
Where life has little value compared to death.
I love you, Django.
So I'm going to be speaking to you guys about this ridiculous proposition that was put forth in the United States by a Senator Glenn Grothman about the removal of Kwanzaa as a holiday, which makes absolutely no sense to me. But anywho, so my story begins when I was channel surfing one day, and I came across an interesting debate on CNN. Now, normally I don't spend too much time watching CNN, but this was one occasion when it was a must. Although I did not hear the whole segment from its beginning, I heard enough to make me question the validity of what was being said. All I could think to myself was, is this for real? The discussion was between, as I said, Wisconsin Senator Glenn Grothman and host Ashley Banfield and Roland Martin concerning his commentary about Kwanzaa, the African-American holiday celebrated on December 26th until January 1st. Grothman was on CNN to clarify his grotesquely ignorant and insensitive comments, such as, quote, why are hardcore left-wingers still trying to talk about Kwanzaa, the supposed African-American holiday celebration between Christmas and New Year's Eve, well, New Year's Day? Or, why must we still hear about Kwanzaa? Kwanzaa is a holiday celebrated by left-wing nuts, because they don't like America and seek to destroy it.
Oh, no.
There's more. He also goes on to say almost all black people ignore Kwanzaa and how he is deeply troubled by the fact that schools are teaching the holiday. Although these are just snippets of his nonsensical rant, it seemed like being on CNN did nothing to clarify what he meant, but instead magnified the intolerance that America has towards other cultures that do not adhere to Western normative views of what constitutes an observed holiday. That is not to say that all of America thinks the way that Senator Grothman does, but when we have an individual in a position of power, so to speak, abusing said position, it makes me question the moral integrity of this person. When does it become acceptable to promote such cultural hatred on the basis of one's personal preference? Personally, if I could be face-to-face with Senator Grothman, I would say, who died and made you God? Where does he get
Amen.
Off? Where does he get off speaking for African Americans on whether or not they celebrate or care about Kwanzaa? Last time I checked, no one person could or speak for, or should speak on behalf of a group of people, especially when they are not knowledgeable on the subject. Senator Grothman, in addition to your expertise on speaking political gibberish, are you also a telepath? That is my question to you. Please answer. How dare he be opposed to children learning about other people's traditions? Mm. I would think he would be supportive of the fact that the youth of today are becoming well-rounded individuals when it comes to the world around them, regardless of one's political views, race, creed, or background. How dare he propose Kwanzaa as a holiday dead set on dividing America when it promotes values such as unity, prosperity, family, which are coincidentally values that most Americans embrace? Well, I guess not all of them. Hint, hint. Interestingly enough, Senator Grothman could not defend himself when he came under scrutiny from both Martin and Banfield. Senator Grothman then enters into a coughing fit in an attempt to counter their arguments, to which the interview is then drawn to a conclusion. His persistence on trying to validate his ludicrous reasoning for removing Kwanzaa as a holiday makes me worry about the extent that blatant racism becomes mobilized through political means in order to further political gains. So I ask you, what are your general feelings on this situation, ladies?
Go, girl. That was well said. You should mail that to him.
Nice little letter.
Fantastic.
After the bow, I support Kwanzaa.
He needs to answer right now, is my
Facebook.
But doesn't it kind of speak to this idea that somehow, because the president of the United States is a black man, and so is the first lady is a black woman, the kids are black, so now kind of racism is over, so therefore the need for Kwanzaa, which was to create a space among the holiday season for an African-American tradition that was unique, mm-hmm. is now not needed because we've overcome this barrier
that, which I'm not saying I agree with that narrative at all, but doesn't do you, I'm just wondering if you think it like fits that general, you know, it's everything's finished, we won.
Definitely.
So now you're still trying to divide us, you know? Like, sure. You definitely Kwanzaa celebrators, you
hard, what do you call it, quote, hardcore left wingers. I love that anyone that doesn't fit in with the capitalistic mainstream is automatically a hardcore left winger, whatever that means.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously to him it's like, as long as you're not Republican and you don't understand, like, I guess Christian values, well, anything aside from that doesn't apply. So, like, for him, like, he has no argument, basically.
It's such horrible rhetoric, too, that CNN is basically legitimizing it by making it a debate, you know, not by forcing him.
Yeah, framing it exactly. As completely ridiculous.
Well, I don't know. Well, it is ridiculous, but...
I mean, we have to question the validity of CNN in itself, because it's CNN, and... Yeah,
they can be reliable sometimes.
But this is the problem. It's like whether or not, like, you think or I think or we all think that CNN's coverage is not good or is not a representation of what we think is important. If it's consulted by a large audience as such, and then it's hosting this as if it's legitimate site of a debate, not asking the senator to resign, to apologize, to recant.
That's true.
You know, it really kind of reinforces how it's a legitimate question. Why do we still celebrate Kwanzaa? Mm-hmm. What's wrong with African Americans who do this? Why do they hate America? Like, it just feeds right. into this.
I mean, if Don Imus can come back and have a full career after the quote nappy headed host comment, then it just shows you like how low the bar is for the American public and the like Western media to be shocked by something.
Definitely.
I don't know.
One more question for you guys. Well, I guess it's been kind of answered, but how do you think this kind of thinking will affect African Americans in the future? And do you think it could influence others to think the same way that Senator Grothman does? And I guess that goes back to what you said, Alyssa, about how it kind of just legitimizes it and there's no repercussions for it. Mm-hmm. But I just want to know what you guys think other than that.
Well, I think that, I mean, I don't personally celebrate Kwanzaa, but I still like it. I mean, it's not, and when I learned about it when I was a teenager, it was really cool. And it was like, oh, like, you know, people were really trying to address the fact that, you know, for Christmas for a lot of people, if you're not upper middle class and you don't have a house or a chimney or, you know, all of these things that come from like the Anglo-Saxon tradition of way of how the Anglo-Saxon kind of Protestant Christian ways of celebrating Christmas, it's not that you don't believe in the same things religiously, but it's just a different, you're coming from the cultural symbols from a different perspective. And I always liked the fact that Kwanzaa at least was an attempt to kind of create a space that wasn't existed. And I feel like this is always how in this era, the way things that were created in response to a lack of inclusion in the past get framed. So Kwanzaa becomes divisive, even though its whole purpose was to create a space. Mm. Affirmative action becomes like discrimination against other people, even though its whole intention was to make workplaces more open and inclusive. Mm. So it's this like constant, you know, disciplining of... And you know, hostility towards efforts that were made to address the fact that things were not universal, but they were treated as such. And I, you know, I don't know what the answer is, because it just seems that the rhetoric and you know, the access to the media for this kind of stuff is increasing. Like, that's my own personal opinion. I don't know. I don't have data or anything to back that
up.
No,
completely.
But
I feel like it reflects a really insidious form of oppression, too, because it's basically about assimilation. Assimilate, become like us. But assimilating to what exactly, and who gets to decide what's the basic standard that we're all assimilating to? And Alyssa's example of even a chimney is so... The cultural context of a chimney is so specific. And so it's assimilating to this very narrow, specific white culture. And that becomes incredibly, incredibly oppressive for anyone from a different culture.
Well, thank you, ladies.
Thank you, Mercedes. I think you should send that to the Mr. Senator, yeah. Man.
We'll all sign it.
Tonight.
I'll sign that.
Yeah.
I'm in. Yes,
listening to Spitfire Women of Color Radio, only on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is now 6:57 p.m. And tomorrow, Thursday, January 31st, CKUT will be hosting their first Rock Against Racism concert series at Catacombs. This event is a fundraiser for the Homelessness Marathon and will feature performers and a film screening. The next Rock Against Racism will be on February 14th, and all funds raised at this event will be donated to Sisters in Spirits. Swing by Catacombs tomorrow night to support this event. We also have McGill's BSN, which will be hosting their annual Black History Banquet named Umoja next Saturday, February 9th, 2013. In the Smoo Ballroom, they will be hosting author David Austin, who wrote Fear of a Black Nation, Race, and Sex Insecurity in Montreal. Tickets are $10, so check them out around the McGill campus.
Thanks, Yasmin. Also, don't forget to check out Cozy's art next Wednesday, February 6th at Au Patre Vis, located at 356 Mont-Royal. The doors open around 6 p.m. Prints will be on sale, and you can see her art for yourself. Or check out her website at www.kosisocuwunnebe.com. Or check out our blog and find the information there too.
On Monday, February 11th, Cinema Political Concordia will be screening United States of Africa. This film was inspired by African hip-hop pioneer DJ Awadi on his quest to craft an album that would pay homage to the greatest black revolutionary leaders and follow their struggles to realize the dream of having a united, independent Africa. In this epic musical and political journey, Awadi visits over 40 countries to collaborate with hip-hop activists. Check out this free screening of United States of Africa, February 11th at 7 p.m. in the Concordia Hall building. There's also a panel discussion, Your Client Has a Profile, Security and Secrecy in Canadian Law. Come out to hear from two of the men who have been at the forefront of the public and legal campaign against immigration, security certificates in Canada. Hear an update on the legal battle and learn about some of the history of national security targeting of communities of color in Montreal. It will be Friday, February 8th, 2013, 5 to 7 p.m., McGill University Faculty of Law, 3644 Peel Street, New